Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show based around ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Saunderson, and Rebecca Watson, as well as regular mystery guest presenters.
Little Atoms makes no claims to balance. We actively promote science, freedom of expression, skepticism, and secular humanism. This means we can often end up talking about superstition, religious fundamentalism, censorship, and conspiracy theory.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Good evening, welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm joined today by our guest, Dr. Richard Elwers. Richard Elwers is a writer, teacher and researcher in mathematics and a visiting fellow at the University of Leeds. He contributes to New Scientist and PLUS magazine and has published research on model theory. Dr. Elwers is passionate about the public understanding of maths, which he promotes at talks and on the radio, like this evening. His books include Maths 1001, Absolutely Everything You Need to Know About Mathematics in 1001 Bite-Sized Explanations, and to be published early in the new year is How to Build a Brain and 34 Other Really Interesting Uses of Mathematics. So, Richard, thanks for joining us on Little Atoms tonight.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
We're going to talk first of all about Maths 1001. Why a book on maths?
Well, from my point of view, it's about the only thing I'm qualified to write,
about.
I don't think I'll be rushing to write any novels anytime soon. But, I mean, I think from my own point of view, my own interest in maths goes back for as long as I can remember. And yet there's a difference between how I see the subject, which is this sort of amazing world of exciting ideas, and I think most people's perception of it, which is a whole bunch of incredibly tedious equations to memorise. And I think that trying to reach over that gap is something well worthwhile doing.
Well, I've just described you as being passionate about the public understanding of maths, and that's clearly tied in with, like, you know, people do think maths is a dry subject, and that may, you know, maybe because that's the way they were taught it.
Well, but there is some truth to it. I mean, it is a dry subject to some extent. I mean, when one really wants to get down and dirty and solve some mathematical problems, you have to think very precisely and dryly, if you like. So that side of the perception is quite accurate. On the other hand, just because it's a dry subject doesn't mean that it's a boring subject, and it doesn't mean there aren't amazing stories about the people who did it and so on.
So who is the book aimed at?
Well, my first book, Maths 1001, is, I think, really aimed at people who have some understanding of math, some background, some level of mathematical education, and really want to see the bigger story. So if you have absolutely no idea about anything to do with maths, it's probably not quite the right book. My second book might be more appropriate. But this one is for people who, you know, they've read a bit about it, maybe studied some of it at school, but only at the sort of level of solving equations, solving the sort of simple problems that one gets set at school, without having any exposure to the sort of great wide world of maths which is out there.
So let's dive straight in then and look at some of the subjects that you look at. The book's divided into, I think there's 10 subject headers.
Right, the 10 chapters.
Well, the first one is numbers, which seems like an obvious, you know, quite an obvious place to start. Numbers being the, you know, the building blocks of mathematics.
It's where it all begins, really. I mean, if you want to say what maths is, the science of numbers is by no means a bad definition. And of course, the story of what numbers are is one which has changed a lot over time, which is something people get surprised by, because you think, you know, a seven is seven, a number is a number. What more can you say? But in recent years, our understanding of the number system has increased a great deal. I mean, the sort of core subject of mathematics, the real central strand, is called number theory. And the type of numbers which are studied in number theory are the positive whole numbers, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are the sort of, you know, the basic building blocks of everything else. On the other hand, mathematicians in the intervening millennia, since people were first tinkering around with those numbers, have discovered all sorts of other types of numbers. I suppose the first extension to that system would be negative numbers, which, of course, people first got interested in when, by dealing in trade. Because if you end the day in profit, you've got a positive result at the end. But if you end the day in debt, then that's a negative result. So to measure profit and debt on a single scale, one needs the positive and the negative numbers.
Well, another part of that same area is this is, we have talked about this on the show before, but it's a really interesting story. I think it sort of bears repeating is that, you know, the idea of zero, which is
yes, I mean, people get surprised that the discovery of zero was the sort of amazing milestone in thought in the history of human thought, because zero, of course, is nothing. It represents nothing, and to start thinking of nothing as being something in its own right requires a mental leap, which it took a long time for people to make. And it really pays off, because once you've got zero, your number system, the one you want to study, has got a lot more power to it. The type of arithmetic you can do is much enriched by having a zero. And that seems totally counterintuitive, because what is zero? It's nothing. But actually, it's everything.
Another one of the types of numbers that we've talked about on the show numerous times, but it's incredibly important to the foundation of maths, is the prime numbers, which there's a lovely quote in the book where you say prime numbers are to mathematicians as atoms are to chemists. They are the building blocks of maths.
That's right. I think that I would stand by that quote, I think. I mean, particularly if you want to understand the whole numbers, then there's this very important theorem, which is called the Fundamental Theorem of Arithmetic, which grand title
that does sound quite fundamental.
Indeed it is. And what it says is that every whole number can be broken down into prime numbers. And what's more, that can only be done in one way. So if you break 1001, to pick a random number, down into prime numbers, it can only be done in one way. They're not two different representations of 1001 as multiples of prime numbers. And this is an important point, because then once we've got this unique representation, really to understand prime numbers automatically gives you a large amount of information about the entire system of numbers.
There's a few other types of numbers that you talk about in the book, and I'd like to just look very briefly at a couple of these examples. And the first one of these is imaginary numbers. What's an imaginary number?
Well, it comes from the idea... To understand what an imaginary number is, you really have to start with negative numbers and how to multiply and add negative numbers. And the key point is that if you multiply a negative number by a negative number, what you end up with is a positive number. So -2 times -2 is actually equal to +4. So now once we've got that, of course it's the same. It's also true that 2 times 2 is equal to +4. So if you want a number which, when multiplied by itself, gives you -4, then there is no number in the ordinary system of whole numbers. There just isn't one. Because if you multiply a positive number by itself, you get a positive, and the same if you multiply a negative number by itself, you get a positive. What mathematicians did was they took the rather bold step of expanding the number system to include what they originally called imaginary numbers, this number I, which when you multiply it by itself gives you -1. And I think it's a really unfortunate fact of history that the name imaginary numbers has stuck, because they're not really imaginary. I mean, mathematicians know how to construct the system of complex numbers. Complex numbers is the sort of broader system which includes the real numbers and the imaginary numbers. And it's as real as any other system of numbers.
So the other example I want to look at very briefly is the idea of rational and irrational numbers. Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about that.
It's nothing to do with being rational as in intelligent or logical or sensible. It's rational as in ratio, and the ratio being a synonym for a fraction. So a rational number is really nothing more than a fraction. So 2/3 or -7/4, it's a fraction of two whole numbers. That's what a rational number is. And the ancient Greeks thought that the rational numbers should be enough. Everything should be able to be expressed just using the rational numbers. But in fact, there's a very elementary example of something which can't be expressed using rational numbers. And it comes from geometry. If you draw a square, which is one unit high, and therefore one unit wide, because squares have all their lengths the same, and then you look at its diagonal, how long is that? Well, the length of the diagonal is a number called the square root of 2. And it turns out that this is not a rational number, meaning that there's no way of writing it as a fraction of whole numbers. And it's rumoured that the chap who discovered this was, in fact, drowned for his heresy against the sanctity of the whole numbers. They didn't like the idea of irrational numbers. But since then, irrational numbers have become incorporated into this wider framework.
You've raised the idea of geometry, and this is the next section of the book, following on from the number section. And you know, last week on the show, we talked about Pythagoras, so it sort of follows on quite well. So one of the things that I find fascinating when looking at the idea of geometry is how much of it, I mean, so much of it was already known by the ancient world. And Euclid's Elements is the key text, is still pretty much a set text of maths, which is like, again, an amazing thing, because unlike ancient science, which has been, you know, gradually superseded over the years, maths is basically always right, which is the...
Right, I mean, it is amazing how many of the theorems about circles and triangles that people learn in school are in fact have their origins in Euclid's Elements. That remains true.
You talk about the difference between there's obviously Euclidean geometry, and anything that we've subsequently discovered is non-Euclidean geometry. So let's talk about what the difference is between those.
Right, well, it comes down to the axiomatic method, if you like, because Euclid's Elements was a very important book, not just for the theorems that it proved, but because of the way it was laid out. Because for the first time, he used this idea of logical deduction. He started off by writing down some very basic assumptions about how points and lines and circles interact, and then he deduced all these famous theorems about triangles and circles from his assumptions. So everything hinges on the assumptions, his initial, which are called Euclid's postulates usually. But he was a bit concerned about one of his postulates, which is called the parallel postulate. And what the parallel postulate says is, if you draw any line, straight line, and then you pick a point which is not on the straight line, there should be exactly one other straight line which goes through your point, which is parallel to your original straight line. And if you experiment with a piece of paper, this seems to be obviously true. But Euclid and plenty of subsequent thinkers didn't think it should be necessary to have this as an axiom, because they thought this should be deducible from his other rather more elementary axioms. And this was a story which ran for literally thousands of years, and plenty of extremely distinguished thinkers attempted to prove the parallel postulate from the simpler other postulates. They all ended in failure for the very reason that, in fact, you can't deduce it. It's independent of the other postulates. And this was proven by a group of mathematicians who individually discovered a new system of geometry where, in fact, all the first of Euclid's postulates hold, but the parallel postulate actually fails. And this is called, this became known as hyperbolic geometry. And that's the sort of classic example of a non-Euclidean geometry. And subsequently, it became quite important in the study of special relativity, in fact.
We're about halfway through the show, so I'll say you listen to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Dr. Richard Elwes about Maths 1001. And you've brought up logic then, so we're going to go now into the idea of logic, and you've raised the idea of the syllogisms, which I was going to talk about, basically Aristotle's idea of syllogism. So let's talk about the importance of logic to maths. And again,
right. Well, I mean, logic is, in a sense, inbuilt into all of maths, because the way we do maths today is, as I was just saying, actually, about how Euclid did it. You start with your initial assumptions, and then you logically deduce theorems from them. And this is, that's the mathematical method, that's how it works. And so, of course, you have to know how to deduce one sentence from previous sentences, how just the process of logical deduction works, what are the sort of basic steps which are valid. And this is what Aristotle studied in great depth, Aristotle's theory of categorical syllogisms, and he analysed in great detail just from when two sentences logically imply a third. But the story's moved on a great deal since Aristotle, as you might expect. And I think a particularly interesting question is to do for number theory, for arithmetic, what Euclid did for geometry. So if you're interested in the system of whole numbers, just 1, 2, 3, 4, and addition and multiplication, what are the fundamental axioms or assumptions from which you can deduce your theorems? And that was a question which was addressed during the 19th century, and this chap called Giuseppe Peano, towards the end of that century, came up with a list of axioms for arithmetic. These are the sort of basic laws which make arithmetic tick. But the real kicker came in 1931 when this chap called Kurt Gödel proved some of the most astonishing theorems that maths has known, and he showed that Peano's system of axioms must be incomplete. That is to say, there would be some statement about numbers such that you could neither prove it nor disprove it just from Peano's axioms. But in fact, it went further than that, because it wasn't just Peano's axioms which were incomplete. I mean, you could say, okay, he just missed some out, we should find out what the fill in the gaps. But in fact, what Gödel showed is that any system of axioms you could possibly write down for arithmetic would always be incomplete. And that was a really shocking result.
I want to bring in the idea of set theory, and we talked a little bit earlier in the pub about Cantor, and basically a similar thing has happened to what you've just described. In that, you know, this. So let's talk first of all about that. Talk about the idea of set theory.
Okay, so I mean, a set is really just any collection of objects. That was the idea, and it seems quite surprising that you should be able to say much about sets. But armed just with that notion, this chap called Georg Cantor managed to develop a whole theory about sets, and in particular about infinite sets. And it was really the first sort of scientific analysis of infinity. And what he proved, using only the idea of a set and the idea of two sets being the same size, if you can match them up, so you can pair up one with the other. So just with that idea, he managed to prove that there isn't just one level of infinity, there are in fact infinitely many levels of infinity. And this was another moment when maths was sort of in shock. Mathematicians weren't sure how to respond to this, because for many people, this was heresy, because maths should relate to the real world. It should tell you stuff about how the real world works. But these very high levels of infinity don't seem to correspond to anything in the real world. So this was another sort of crunch moment.
Well, I mentioned that we talked about Pythagoras on the last week's show, and another one of the people that came up in that discussion was Bertrand Russell. And this is relevant to what we're talking about now, because there is something called the Russell's paradox, which is...
So Russell's paradox really threatened to kill off Cantor's theories of infinity. These have been developed in the late 19th century, and then Bertrand Russell, just from the idea of a set, produced this horrible paradox. So shall I say what it is?
Yes, go ahead. Okay, yeah, it's incredibly simple, but profound.
So if a set is just any collection of objects. So in particular, we can talk about the set of all sets. Okay? And this has a rather mysterious property in that it must include itself, because it is a set. So some sets then include themselves and others don't. So we might call the ones that include themselves exotic sets, and the ones which don't, the plain sets. That's what most collections of objects look like, right? So then Bertrand Russell asked this impossible question, which is he looked at all the set of plain sets, right? And he asked, does that include itself? Is the set of all plain sets plain or exotic? And you play around with it in your mind for a bit, and you realise that it doesn't work either way. Either assumption produces a contradiction. If it is, then it isn't, and if it isn't, then it is.
Tell us the Barber paradox. Can you sort of, because that sort of that relays it in a sort of real world example.
Yeah, so it's a real world translation of Russell's paradox. And the idea is that there's an island where the men get shaved every day. Some shave themselves, and some get shaved by the barber. Right. The key point is that the men who the barber shaves are exactly those who don't shave themselves. Okay. And then the question is, who shaves the barber? Does he shave himself or not?
Yeah, because if he shaves himself, then he belongs to...
He must be one of the people who don't shave themselves. And if he doesn't shave himself, then he's one of the people who the barber shaves.
So, we are bringing, obviously, Bertrand Russell into it. We're sort of straying onto the territory of philosophy. And again, you get onto the chapter in the book which is about something called meta-mathematics. And you raise the ideas of the sort of philosophy of mathematics. And, you know, a lot of people will think that maths is sort of a very practical thing, a sort of technical language that's everything uses maths. But let's talk a little bit about, you know, this idea of in fact, actually, before we sort of get onto the idea of the philosophy of maths, perhaps paradoxically we could have started off the program by asking this question, but you start that chapter off by saying basically, what do mathematicians do?
Right. I suppose the quick answer is mathematicians prove theorems. That's the main thing they want to do.
So what does that mean?
Well, actually, I mean, we've covered quite a lot of the material already. I mean, I think the proof is the key to it. Mm-hmm. So the idea of logical deduction. So we've talked about logic and Aristotle's theory, and then, of course, you've got to start off with premises. So we've covered that. So I mean, I think we've done quite well. And then, but then, of course, mathematicians have there are all sorts of takes on these things. So they have particular ways of proving things. I guess an interesting one is proof by contradiction, or it's called reductio ad absurdum.
Yeah, that's a good example. Let's
okay.
So talk about
suppose I want to prove some statement. Let's call it B. Okay, and my hypothesis, my axiom, if you like, is A, right? So what I want to prove is that A implies B. Well, proof by contradiction turns it on its head, okay? So instead of trying to prove B directly, I assume that B doesn't hold. I assume not B, if you like. And then I can deduce nonsense. If I can deduce nonsense from that, in particular, if I can deduce not A, then I've got a contradiction because A was my assumption, right? So if I can deduce any contradiction, of course, and this works for all sorts of things. But the idea is if you want to prove a statement, then assume it's false and deduce nonsense from it. And that's proof by contradiction. And this is a prized technique to many mathematicians because it's surprisingly powerful.
Let's talk a little bit perhaps about the... We've got some time left. There's the very language that's used. There's a particular language that's used in terms of looking for proof. And let's talk about basically what the difference between a conjecture and a theorem is.
Okay, well, a conjecture is something that some particular mathematician believes to be true, but he hasn't been able to manage to prove it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's conjecture. It's something, you know, you put Elwes's conjecture would be something that I hold to be true, but I can't prove it. So then it's there and anyone can have a crack at it. And yeah, maths is as full of conjectures as it is of theorems. But of course, some of them get knocked on their head. Some of them turn out not to be true.
But then once they are proved, then that is the point where you can then call it.
Then you can call it a theorem. And then of course there's a great quarrel about who gets the name. Is it the person who proved it? I mean, Fermat's last theorem is a bit of a contradiction in this discussion because of course Fermat couldn't prove it. Nevertheless, somehow he managed to get his name attached to it.
So it's a long time ago now, but I remember when Marcus de Soto was on the programme, we talked about this idea of there was a mathematician, David Hilbert, back in the beginning of the 20th century, who basically came up with 23 problems that hadn't been solved, and basically a challenge. It was a sort of challenge that was laid down. And coming right up to date, there's the same thing happened, called the Clay Institute Millennium Problems,
yeah.
which were seven problems that were put down, and there's like £1 million prize.
$1 million, I think. Yeah.
$1 million prize.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it was a deliberate attempt, I think, to echo Hilbert's speech from 1900. He sort of set the direction of maths for the 20th century, and I think the Clay Institute in the year 2000 wanted to see if they could do the same thing again. So they set these seven problems, of which only one of them has so far yielded, and that was the Poincaré conjecture, which was hypothesized by Henri Poincaré in the early 20th century, and that uniquely, out of the Clay Institute problems, has been solved in just a few years ago. In 2002, I think the proof went in.
So, what are perhaps another one of the examples of ones that are? Is there examples there that can't be? You know, that probably can't be proved.
I don't think we know. Certainly, no one's talking in terms of things that can't be proved. But certainly there are plenty of... I mean, who knows when these things will go? I mean, I guess the Riemann hypothesis...
The Riemann hypothesis is the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yes, it's the most famous of all, probably. And that's to do with how the prime numbers are distributed. And, who knows if it can be proved? I mean, it probably will be proved sooner or later. But, I mean, in the next 50 years, 100 years, 1,000 years, who knows?
It's just occurred to me that in the last couple of minutes we haven't spoke about How to Build a Brain, which is your book that's coming out. It's been published in March. So that's what we should to finish off by just talking about how does How to Build a Brain and 34 other really interesting uses of mathematics differ from Maths 1001?
It's I think the in terms of the content there's actually not an enormous amount of difference. Most of the maths in the second book is also included in this book for the very good reason that Maths 1001 was meant to be as comprehensive as possible. But How to Build a Brain is much more in the sort of classic strain of popular science. It's very few equations in it. It should be accessible to people who are, you know, have some, who are anyone who's interested really, without having to have any expertise whatsoever. Whereas Maths 1001 is just for people who, you know, with a slightly more experience of it. I think that's the main difference. It's, you know, it's shorter, it's more lighthearted.
What sort of things? Do you give us a quick example of some of the things that you look at in there?
Well, quite a few of the things we've discussed already, mm-hmm. actually. So yeah, Gödel's theorems are in there. Cantor's stuff is in there. The Poincaré conjecture is in there. So I mean, maybe I should say a little bit more about the Poincaré conjecture. So that's one of the Clay Institute problems which has been settled, and that's a key theorem in the area of topology. It's like geometry, which is it's the mathematical study of shapes. The difference being that in topology, we count two shapes as being the same if one can be bent or twisted into the shape of the other. So in geometry, a circle and a square are two different things, but to a topologist, because you can bend a square into the shape of a circle, they're the same thing. And Poincaré conjecture is about what happens when you step up a dimension, or two dimensions. You start looking at spheres, and then you look at higher dimensional spheres. And in particular, which shapes have got no holes in them, right? So this question of whether a shape's got holes in it turns out to be an incredibly deep question, which it took mathematicians many, many years to solve. And that's really what Poincaré's conjecture is. And the answer is that up to topology, the only shapes that have got no holes in them are spheres.
I think that's a good deep question for our listeners to be thinking about over the weekend, because we're out of time. So I've been talking to Dr. Richard Elwes about his book Maths 1001, mainly. Richard, thank you very much for being on Little Atoms tonight.
A pleasure. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests on our website at littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.